Good afternoon. I'm Jim Fawcett, FAA, from Atlanta, and I'll be introducing the program to you today. I'd like to welcome you to the Architect-Led Design Build, a Practical Business Plan, session number FR59. Before we get started with the program, let me pass on some information that AIA considers valuable to you. Your badge is programmed to record the continued education credits. This session will allow you to earn 1.5 learning units. If you did not swipe your badge outside the room, please step out and do so now because the machine will cut down in about 15 minutes and you would not receive credit for this session. If you need a transcript of your CE activities, stop by the CES information desk in the reception area. Members are expected to receive credits from this convention within about 3 weeks. You should receive your transcripts. If you're not an AIA member and need record of attendance, please contact AIA and they will furnish this to you. Please do not stop with your continued education efforts at this convention. AIA has a wealth of opportunities to continue CE credits. We ask that you get involved in a knowledge community that interests you or is in close coordination with your practice in the area in which you live. Many of the seminars will be available on eClassroom. A single audio CD of this program will also be available, as well as a full conference CD-ROM, and that will be available in the ACTS booth in the registration area. As part of the Greening Convention theme, you will have the opportunity to evaluate this session and other sessions online. So please look at email. We ask that you take some time, evaluate the sessions, the content, and the speakers, because this will give AIA an opportunity to determine what is going to be value of to you and others who attend next year. I do have a special announcement. Is Bernard Dunlap in the room? Bernard, would you check with the Continuing Education Office? Something of value to you has been found, and they'd like to return it to you after this session. We will not ask you to tell us what that is. Okay, as usual, I'm going to ask if you will check any electronic devices, phones, pagers, etc., and turn those off before the session starts. Now, it's my privilege to introduce our speaker, Mark C. Freelander. Mark is an attorney with Schiff Hardin LLP in Chicago. Mark is a professional affiliate of AIA. He is also a professor in the School of Architecture at UIC in Chicago. So, Mark, welcome, and I'll turn the session over to you.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate you spending the end of your Friday afternoons, particularly with a lawyer. I know that lawyers are not popular in the construction industry, and in fact, many people in the industry think that our primary role ought to be the butt of some good jokes. For example, do you know why there are so many lawyers in New York and so much environmental waste in New Jersey? Because New Jersey got first choice. Or the more relevant one about the doctor, the architect, and the lawyer who were playing golf one day and got into an argument over which one was the world's oldest profession, ignoring what's sometimes referred to as the world's oldest profession. And the doctor said that it had to be medicine, because medicine went as far back as the first people. The first humans, he claimed, were Adam and Eve. And Eve was created by cutting open Adam's chest, extracting and planting a rib from which she supposedly sprang full grown. And that was surgery or medicine. So medicine had to be the world's oldest profession because it went as far back as the first people. Well, the lawyer and the architect thought for a moment, then the architect started shaking his head and said, "No, architecture goes back further than that. In the beginning," he said, "the universe was nothing but chaos. But out of that chaos, order was created. Planets and orbits, stars and galaxies. A god was originally referred to as the celestial architect. So architecture, he claimed, had to be the oldest profession, going back beyond the first people and beyond medicine. Well, you could see the doctor fuming at that, but the lawyer started to smile, looked at the other two, and asked, "Ah, but who do you think created the chaos?" So what we're going to do here today is exactly the opposite. We're going to dispel the chaos that currently exists around the concept of design-build in general and architect-led design-build in particular. Architect-led design-build was blasphemy 50-plus years ago, and yet design-build, led by architects or whatever, is as old as the pyramids, literally. Until the beginning of the 20th century, almost all construction was done design-build, and there really wasn't a clear distinction between the design professional and the contractor. Actually, what I'm going to tell you, as a lawyer who represents probably the plurality of architects in the Chicago area, including their professional liability companies, is that design-build, led and controlled by the architect, is a better, more lucrative, and believe it or not, safer way of doing business with regard to liability than the way you're practicing today. Now, design build isn't new, but what we're going to learn today is a surprisingly novel application of it involving a series of contracts. And that's one of the first elements of the chaos that I want to dispel. That, especially here in Texas, there is an assumption that design-build involves a single contract for both design and construction. There's even a Texas statute that says that, and that's simply false. It's not true at all. Design-build doesn't depend on how many contracts there are. Design-build occurs when the design professional and the contractor are either the same entity or members of the same team, and it doesn't matter how many contracts they use in order to produce the project. In fact, one of my clients in Chicago, who's the CEO of a major national integrated design-build team with its own design-build firm with its own in-house architecture, tells me that they use a multiple contract system as their best way of bringing in business. First, he says, they'll sometimes do a feasibility kind of study. It may even be based on a handshake. There's no real liability attached to it. They're just doing some basic analysis to figure out whether a project makes sense or not to do. It's billed on a pure hourly basis with the understanding that the fees are going to be small and the deliverable is a simple report. Then, if the project seems feasible, the client may hire them under a second contract to take the project through schematics, with the deliverable mostly being some pretty pictures that the client can use to increase interest, awareness, to raise money for the project, or whatever. And if the project is still a go at that point, then there may be a third contract to take the project through design development, or into design development at least, and preliminary pricing, to put some numbers on it, actually where the deliverable is a design-build proposal to finish the project for X dollars by such and such date. And if that seems feasible and the financing is there and everything else lines up, then there may be a fourth contract, which is to finish the drawings and to build the project. Four contracts, back to back to back to back, which when you put them all together is a design-build project. So don't get hung up on the number of contracts necessary. Simply focus on who is providing the services and under what structure. That's what really makes the difference. Now, traditionally, design build is done by contractors. More than 60% of the design build that's done, at least in the United States, has a contractor acting as the design builder. That's partly because contractors have been more entrepreneurial. In the 50s and around that era, the AIA actively discouraged architects from being design builders. Also, contractors have always thought that they should be leading teams because 90% or so of the revenue from a construction project tends to flow through the contractor rather than the design team. So it seemed to them quite natural that they should be the design build leader or the head of a design build team. What I'm going to teach you today is a way to achieve approximately the opposite. We'll go into more detail, and I'll show that this is a little bit oversimplistic. But what I'm going to show you is that architect-led design-build is more logical, It's more logical because usually you have the client contact first. You're usually working with a client before there's even a contractor in the picture. That you are the professionals who are trained to balance design issues with cost and constructability issues. When contractors lead design build teams, as we've all heard and seen, often constructability and cost issues dominate and you get, let's call it, average architecture. For a long time, design build was criticized for turning out less than high quality architectural products. But that's always been because contractors have led the team. Another misconception that I want to clear up is the idea that in order for an architect to be a design-build contractor, that you need to have all of the contractor's capabilities in-house, that you're going to be hiring multiple prime trades and coordinating them and estimating with them and handling their contracts and all the other administrative details. It doesn't have to be that way. Instead, I'm going to show you a structure where you can team with a general contractor who will be working under you with the trades under the general contractor. And there's nothing unfair, unethical, or unrealistic about it. It's just the flip side of the coin of what happens most of the time today. You'll be establishing a strategic alliance, a kind of teaming arrangement with one or more general contractors who will be your 100% subcontractors for construction. Now, I told you that the last slide was a bit of an oversimplification. Being a lawyer, one of my jobs is to minimize the risks to you and your companies. As your lawyer, or as a lawyer, I tell you that the best way for you to structure your firm to do design build work is to split it into two separate companies. And that's not really a fair way of saying it. Your architecture firm stays exactly identically as it is today. But you start a new company, a new corporation or whatever as well, and it's a paper shell corporation. It doesn't have to have its own employees. It's just a plaque on the door and a bunch of paperwork plus a registration at the Secretary of State's office. It will be your construction company or your design build company. But the key is that, in the eyes of the law at least, it's a non-professional company. Architects are professionals. Contractors, even if they're every bit as knowledgeable, are not legally considered professionals. And that has all kinds of implications for liability, insurance, and other issues, which as we proceed through a typical project, you'll see make all the difference in the world in terms of how you can actually get involved in a project like a contractor, be involved in means, methods, and procedures safely. I know all the lawyers you've had throughout the history of your architectural careers have been telling you architects cannot get involved in job site safety or in means and methods and procedures of construction. And to an extent, they're right, if you were to do so as an architect. But if you do so as a construction company or a design build company, which is insured differently, there's no reason you can't be every bit involved as involved in those elements as a contractor is today. Furthermore, the key element of having a non-professional design-build company is that it can make guarantees that you couldn't make as an architect. You know that as an architect, you're held to a standard of care, the levels of skill, care, and diligence that the average typical design professional in a similar situation would employ. As a contractor, that's not true. The construction division of your firm, if you want to call it that, is instead just like any other contractor, and it makes guarantees all the time. It guarantees a price, it guarantees a completion date, and you too will be able to do that, and you'll find it amazing how that can change your marketing, even for architectural projects. I'm showing you now the easy slide, the single contract approach. There's nothing unique about this. This type of design build has been around forever. If you have a client who knows from day one that what they want to do is to have a design build project, this is how you would structure it, and this is no problem. In fact, the new AIA design build documents are perfectly fine for this kind of structure. They're quite good documents. There's no harm in using them. Your design build company would hold the design build contract with the owner. It would have a subcontract with your own architectural firm, which sounds silly, doesn't it? One of your divisions contracting with the other division. But it's there for the third parties to see, for the outside world, so that your architectural duties are narrowly defined in a proper contract. And your design-build company would subcontract the construction, 100% of it, to your allied, teamed general contractor. And each of you would have consultants and subcontractors, et cetera. Nothing unique about this. It's done all the time. And when it's done by some other design-build company, instead of saying architect's design-build company here, it would say real estate design-build company, like Mesero Stein or HBE for healthcare, or any of those other companies that do design-build. The much more interesting and the new information about design-build is what I call sequential design-build. And by sequential, I simply mean that there are a series of contracts in sequence that constitute this design-build relationship. And this is a very simple and obvious process. When I explain it to you, you'll shake your heads and say, why isn't it done like this more often? And to be honest with you, I don't know. It's so obvious that I'm embarrassed to say that I'm kind of, I don't know if it's inventing it or if somebody did it before me that I never heard of, but it deserves to be widely publicized because it is so logical and so advantageous for you. One of the very nice things about the sequences of contracts is that the very first contract you have with a party includes, kind of by reference, the subsequent contracts. That means you don't have to renegotiate the terms each time you enter into a new level of contracting. Your very first contract will describe what the next contract would be. It might even have it stapled to it, so that there's nothing else to negotiate. Once the client signs up, everything follows a natural course, and it will seem incredibly logical to you. The only drawback I've been able to find about, or at least the only serious one about this kind of structure, is that it's new. A lot of people don't understand it and are nervous or, jealous of it or whatever. You have a lot of problems teaching old dogs new tricks. In a situation like this, the contractor and architect are going to be cooperating very closely. There are a lot of grisly old field supervisors who have never heard of such a concept and have a hard time learning a new way of doing business. There will be clients you will have who have never heard of it either and need to be taught how it works to their benefit as well. Let me briefly take you through the elements here, and then we'll go through a chronology of a sample project. The black line between the owner and the architect is a design contract. The dotted triangle in the middle is a design-build proposal among those three parties. And then the black line between the owner and the architect's design-build company is a construction contract. Very simple. One contract to the second contract to the third contract, and it will lead to a complete design-build job. Moreover, this structure is a classic win-win-win structure. It benefits you, of course, in ways we'll talk about, but it benefits the owner probably even more. And what's amazing, what I had really needed time to figure out for myself, seeing it in action, is that it's better for contractors as well. And the contractors who figured out how this works are happy and anxious to be your 100% subcontractor for construction. This structure also works in virtually all niches of practice. In the public sector, it's got to be modified somewhat. And in fact, I've published an article just a couple of weeks ago and brought some copies with me. For those of you who do a great deal of public sector work, please come on up afterwards and take a copy because it's not part of the AIA materials. It came out too recently. The other niche that it's not necessarily best for is one where you have a client who wants the lowest possible cost at all costs, that's the primary consideration, your classic developer type for whom saving every dollar is critical. But for any client who's on a budget, for whom a budget is important, for whom a dollar saved under the budget isn't as important as avoiding going a dollar over the budget, and I see a lot of you nodding, that's most of the clients, this structure is better than traditional architecture today. Let me take you through it step by step because it makes a lot of sense and it's hard to understand unless you actually see how it works in practice. So step one is arranging to develop one or more general contractor teammates. This teaming agreement is a contract. It's like a strategic alliance agreement. It's logical. In fact, if you follow modern business trends, but the strongest business arguments are in favor of developing strategic alliances for the things that aren't a business's core competency. An architect's core competency is design and the production of construction documents. No one's claiming that you should have the expertise in-house actually to administer the construction of a project. Not administer a contractor, but be the constructor yourself. The better way to obtain that kind of ability is to acquire it by a strategic alliance with one or more contractors. Now, step one occurs before you've even thought of a single project. This is to make sure that you have the capability of marketing and going for design-build projects. When you talk to general contractors to select a couple to do this, and I recommend that you have more than one general contractor teammate, but not a lot. A design build works best when there is a promise of future business that's implied. It's doing continued business together that acts as a very strong incentive to cooperate on this project so as not to blow the business relationship for the future. Which means that by having more than one general contractor, you're not beholden to that one, but by having two or three, you can spread the work around, and yet it's not spread so thin that a general contractor doesn't think that he'll ever be working with you again. So two or three are probably ideal numbers for a typical design-build strategic alliance. Now, what kind of criteria do you use when selecting a general contractor to be your teammate? Well, there's one key criterion, and then the rest are somewhat permissive. The key criteria is that this general contractor's got to be financially solvent. Not necessarily bonded, but at least be bondable. Have a balance sheet strong enough that he's not going to go broke on you. Because if he goes broke and he's your 100% subcontractor for construction, you're left holding the bag to the owner with nobody else backing you up. So you want to make sure that the general contractor is financially sound. You also want to pick a general contractor who is what I call a professional-style general contractor rather than your typical claims contractor. You're not looking for a contractor who specializes in hard competitive bids and sharp pencils and making up the difference with change orders and requests for extras. You're looking for a contractor who understands professionalism, who works mostly on a negotiated basis. You know who I'm talking about. You probably all work to some extent with that kind of contractor. The more professional the contractor and the more appreciative they are of design quality, the better the team is going to function. And in addition, there are other factors. The size of the contractor compared to the size of the likely project. The geographic location of the contractor to make sure that they know and can mobilize people in the precise location that you're doing the work. And the construction niche. A residential contractor is going to be very different from an industrial contractor, and you want to pick one who's very familiar with the kind of work that you do. When you've selected the contractor, then you and the contractor enter into what I call a teaming agreement. It's an actual contract that you sign. There's not a whole lot that it binds anybody to do except to function together as a team. There are two major parts to it. The first is the agreement for pre-construction services. The general contractor agrees that when you ask it to for a particular project, they will come into your office and provide the typical kinds of pre-construction services that you're used to seeing now. They will provide cost estimating, scheduling, constructability analysis, the standard kinds of things that you're used to working with a general contractor during the design phases now. Nothing new there. They will also, however, be providing conceptual estimating. I assume you all know what that is. Conceptual estimating is different from regular estimating in that it's done on a very incomplete set of documents. Regular estimating is done with a full set of CDs. Conceptual estimating is often done during the design development phase. In contractor-led design build, it's done all the time. They get information from the design professional, which isn't really a set of design development drawings or even a cohesive set of drawings. It's information about the various systems of the building, so that they can price those systems. And some contractors are better at conceptual estimating than others. You'd be well advised to talk about that and make sure that your contractor teammate is strong at conceptual estimating. The second part of the teaming agreement is an agreement to subcontract. It itself has two parts. The first part says, if you as the architect design builder are awarded the project and are hired to build it, you promise that if the contractor performed the pre-construction services, you will award the construction contract to them. In other words, you're not going to make them bid for it. If they've helped you get the job is theirs, period. And they, in turn, promise to accept the subcontract. They won't say, no, I don't want it. Or worse yet, they won't say, no, but it's going to cost more than the price that you quoted to the owner, which would be disastrous, of course. So it causes the contractor to agree to accept the subcontract under your design build firm with numbers consistent with the numbers that you gave the owner. So if you told the owner that it was going to be a $1 million project, including all over markups for overhead and profit, the contractor would be agreeing with you to build the project for you for, let's just say, $950,000, the difference being the overhead and profit markups and the markups for your construction phase services. So, step one, you've signed up one or more general contractors to be your teammate, and now you're ready to market for the first design-build project. We move to step two, which is the architect's contract. You're in a beauty contest. It's a client who doesn't even know what design build is. You, however, are all ready to do design build if anybody should ask you. This one hasn't asked you. Instead, he's called you to the same kind of beauty contest that you've been in many times before, where they ask you for your firm background expertise to sell yourself, even though, in most of the times, your clients don't know enough about architecture to truly distinguish between two different firms. But you have a way to distinguish yourself from every other architect they might ever talk to if you're ready to do design build. Try this out. Let me be your marketing consultant here, and I will tell you the pitch that my architect clients who are doing design build use, and tell me if you think it would be persuasive to an owner. You stand up, you look the owner in the eye, and you say, and on top of everything else, in addition to our design quality and history and expertise, I'm prepared to make a promise to you, a guarantee. My firm will guarantee to you that this project comes in on time and on budget. And more than that, I will put that guarantee in writing and sign it as part of my contract, provided, of course, that you hire me to build it as well as design it, because I can guarantee my own construction services, not anybody else's. You hear that? All of your lawyers for years have been telling you architects don't make guarantees. It's not insurable. You can't do that. And they're right. But because you have design build capability, you've set up your design build company who is a non-professional, that company can make the guarantees. And because, like any contractor, can sign a contract that has a completion date and a price in it as a hard and firm guarantee. Now, I'll tell you, I was surprised, but one of the outcomes of my clients who are doing this is that they find they're getting pure architectural work, not design build, that they wouldn't have gotten before. Their clients are doing a double take when they make this promise or guarantee, and they're saying, I'm going to hire you. You're the only architect who's had the courage to put your money where your mouth is. And there's a lot of truth to that. A lot of our clients don't understand why, as architects, we can't make these guarantees. And this puts you back in the mainstream of business expectations, able to promise things that you always wanted to be able to promise, but never legally or really with experience were able to do. So how does this work? Well, it works by signing up the client for a design contract to begin with. The client doesn't really understand design build yet, and all he knows is that he was impressed by your guarantee. So he hires you to be the architect, and you sign him up to your standard B141 contract or whatever contract you use for design professional services. That contract, however, will have a guarantee form as an exhibit to it. It'll have a line at the end that says, if the owner elects to convert this project to design-build, that will happen by filling out and signing the guarantee form attached here to as Exhibit A, which is stapled right there in blank. The blanks aren't filled out yet because nobody's asked you to go design-build yet. And your architecture contract is signed. Now, you start working with the client, you start programming, you start doing schematic work, you develop relationships. They learn to trust you. They learn of your expertise and are impressed. And one day your client comes to you and says, and it's beginning of design development perhaps, did you mean what you said about guaranteeing the construction price? And you said, absolutely, if we do this project as design build. And they say, well, what does that mean? And you explain to them how it means that instead of the owner hiring the contractor, you hire a contractor to work with you under your supervision to make sure that the project turns out right. And the owner says, well, I think that's the way I'd like to go. And in fact, you know, it occurred to me after, you know, years after I came up with this structure, it hit home solidly when my wife and I built an addition onto our house in the Chicago suburbs. We, our best friends are a husband and wife architect pair, and we hired them to do the second story addition. And, you know, I thought I knew everything there was to know about architecture and construction contracts. And yet I found there were two points in the process where I was very nervous, just like the average typical client of yours. The first was that, and we were doing this traditionally, the first was that I had a clear budget, but had no way of knowing how to conform my program to the budget. We thought that my program should be doable within the budget, but we weren't sure, and there was no way to know till the CDs were more or less done and it was sent out for competitive bidding. It could have been that we'd have to value engineer it way down, or we could have left all kinds of room. We didn't know, so that was a lack of sleep. And then when we were fortunate enough that one of the three contractors who bid the CDs did come in at budget, then I started to worry about this contractor. I didn't know the contractor. I mean, all of a sudden, I was going to be entrusting my house to somebody I didn't know at all. And I know that an architect just is never in a position to control the contractor and assure that the project works out okay. That's what many of your clients think, but I knew better, and that made me very nervous. I would have been thrilled if I could have gone to my architect friends and said, you know, if you could build this and promise that it would come in within budget, I would be so much happier. And that's essentially what this allows you to do. So step two is getting hired to begin the project with a client having at some point the ability to convert the project to design build. Step three, the design build proposal. Your client has now come to you and said, I liked that guarantee. Will you act on it for me? Will you guarantee the cost and completion date of the project? Now, usually this happens in schematic phase, late schematic phase, early design development, but it's not actually critical when it happens. Either way, it's supposed to happen early enough that you're going to have to conceptually estimate the project rather than do a hard takeoff because you don't have anything near complete CDs at this point. So at this point in time, you call your general contractor teammate and have them come to your office, and you show them the drawings and take them through the project. And you talk about the program, and you discuss it between the two of you. And you start working out conceptually how the project is likely to be finished. You probably already, as you're sitting there, have a fairly good square foot kind of understanding of what the likely price is going to be, depending on quality of finishing features and things like that. The contractor, too. And between the two of you, you'll come up with definition on how those features are going to be completed and how the drawings will be detailed. You won't actually detail the drawings, but you'll come up with a list, so you'll know that there are going to be granite countertops rather than formica or whatever it may be. And finally, your contractors are actually pretty good at this when they do conceptual estimating. And you'll end up generating a list of design assumptions that aren't yet drawn up or detailed, but are nevertheless the assumptions on which the project is going to be based. And then you fill out this form, which I've drafted to make it very salesworthy. It's very friendly looking to an owner. The beginning of it is guaranteed price, colon, and a big blank. Guaranteed completion date, colon, and a big blank. And you fill those out based on what numbers you've gotten from the general contractor plus appropriate markups that you'll have discussed and possibly worked out in advance. There will also probably be a margin depending on how early in the project it is. The later you do this, the more definition you'll have and the less of a margin that you'll need. And of course, you can refine that margin later on. But then you fill out this design-build proposal. And if the owner likes the price, likes the completion date, then all three of you sign it. Now, the three I'm talking about does not include the general contractor. The general is your sub. He doesn't sign a contract directly with your client. It is the owner who signs it, you as an architectural firm who signs it, and you as the architect's design-build company that signs it. And that's this dotted triangle in the middle. It's a three-party contract. And its primary terms are the four things that I've listed on the bottom of the slide. The first points out that your guarantee is contingent on building the project. You're not guaranteeing what it might cost if somebody else built it. If he ever hires someone else to build your project, the guarantee is void. So it only covers your own building of the project. The reason that three parties signed this document is that it provides for the architect's design build company to take over during the construction phase. Once the drawings are done, once construction begins, actually, the drawings may not yet be finished, once construction starts, your design build company is the entity through which you are providing the services to take your professional firm out of all the construction phase liabilities that occur. Is this beginning to make sense now? Construction worker gets injured, it doesn't matter to you because your architecture firm wasn't active during the construction phase, so there's no logical way even to make a claim against it. There are legal safeguards that I've built into these documents. One is an anti-budget busting provision. The owner can't insist on upgrading the quality or quantity of the materials and still hold to your budget. If the owner changes the design assumptions, and by the way, the design assumptions become an exhibit to this document, so they're hard and fast and are recorded, then he voids the guarantee unless he's willing to cut somewhere else to make up for it. So the owner can't bust your budget. The other thing the owner has to do is if he hires you to do all of this estimating work, and it takes some time, the owner is promising that you'll be able either to build the project, or if it doesn't get built, he'll compensate you for all the estimating work that you've done. The way I've drafted it, I've quantified that at 1% of the guaranteed cost of construction if for some reason the project never goes ahead or worst comes to worst, he actually hires somebody else to build it. But you get compensated for everything, so you are made whole and, in fact, earn a little bit of extra profit because it's not a full 1% usually that it costs to do this estimating. And finally, the document provides that there will be a future construction contract which looks like this, so that one contract introduces the next contract, and that when you're ready for construction, that contract will be signed and it will supersede this proposal. Because by then, things will probably have changed. The design assumptions will probably have changed as the owner interjects its preferences, and probably the cost or even completion date may have changed somewhat, and the current version of those numbers would go into the construction contract. And then we're ready for step four. Step four occurs before your documents are completed most of the time. One of the big advantages of design-build, no matter who's leading the team, is the ability to fast-track the construction process without losing cost control at all. So in a project like this, as soon as the contractor is ready to start site clearance or excavation or whatever it might be, it can go ahead and start even though you haven't finished detailing the construction documents yet, which, as you know from fast-tracking, reduces the overall project duration by overlapping the phases. And that's a huge advantage to most owners, especially industrial owners. In fact, it's such an advantage to industrial owners that in the industrial sector alone, design-build, which for them is called EPC, engineer, procure, construct, industrial design build, essentially, is the majority project delivery method already, because time is everything in industry, and nothing but design build is capable of fast-tracking a project without losing cost control. So the construction will begin even before the documents are done. As soon as you're ready to begin construction, your design-build company enters into the construction contract with the owner. This will be the contract that was introduced in the design-build proposal. It's your basic, simple construction contract. You don't want to have it be huge and elaborate because, to be honest, a lot of the detail favors the owner, and the contractor is almost better off with simpler contracts. So you even have the advantage here of being able to offer the owner a very simple, non-legalistic kind of contract that many owners find they don't even bother to send to a lawyer. And this contract is a pure lump sum construction contract. Let's use round numbers here just so that it's easier to comprehend. Let's say that the cost of construction that you've quoted, including all markups, et cetera, is $1 million. There will be a lump sum construction contract now between your design build company and the owner for $1 million. As soon as that contract is inked, you turn around and issue the equivalent of a purchase order to your general contractor teammate. Now you ask, where did that purchase order come from? The answer, it's attached as an exhibit to the teaming agreement that you signed up in step one. It already predicts what the future contract will look like. And it's so simple. It really is a purchase order. It says that you as the general contractor agree to do 100% of the construction services that I just promised to do for the owner in this construction contract, which is stapled and attached here too. And as compensation for your construction work, Mr. General Contractor, I will pay to you, I think it's best for it to be a GMP contract, GMP subcontract. So I will reimburse you for all of your costs plus markup up to a guaranteed maximum price of, let's use the number, $950,000. With the $50,000 delta from that contract to the $1 million lump sum contract being your markup for your construction phase services and your overhead and profit. That's 5% of the construction cost for construction phase services. Normally, you get in the vicinity of 1% for construction phase services. And in reality, your construction phase services under this structure aren't all that much greater than what they are today because you're not really doing the construction. You're supervising and administering it, but not doing it. So you will find that the construction phase will be a profit center that will dwarf your design phase profits. I mean, the typical architectural firm for a successful contract traditionally will earn maybe half of 1% of the construction cost as its profit at the end of the job if everything goes smoothly. If it doesn't, the profit gets eaten up and more. It's not a high profit industry. And that's silly when you have a second contract from which you could profit. Think of it like a business theoretician. If you have, let's call it control of the owner, the owner's confidence, there are two profit opportunities in a construction project. One is the architecture contract, and you take advantage of that. The other is the construction contract. And today you give away that profit opportunity, getting nothing in return for it. This structure is financially beneficial for you because it allows you to share the construction profits with the general contractor. And what's hidden in this is that this process is so much more financially efficient between you and the general contractor that the total profits are considerably higher and your share of them leaves more than enough profit for the general contractor. So what you have now is a relationship where the owner's hired you at a lump sum of $1 million and you've hired the general contractor to do the same scope of work for a guaranteed maximum price of $950,000. Let's see how that kind of project works out. Let's assume three different possibilities. First, that it comes in right on the numbers. Now, by right on the numbers, I mean the $950,000 that you hired the contractor to do it for. If that's the case, the owner pays you $1 million and you pay the contractor $950,000. And that means that the contractor goes away fully happy. He's made exactly what he had guessed to make on the job. No losses or overruns whatsoever. You earn 5% of the construction cost approximately for your construction phase services, which include essentially most of the same kinds of things that you'll do today. They would include pay request analysis and review. You know, a general contractor or the upper tier contractor or a construction manager does pretty much the same kind of pay request review that an architect traditionally does. You'll do submittal reviews. Yes, you typically do that as an architect, but general contractors review, or at least are supposed to review, their subcontractors' submittals as well. So it's not unusual for the prime contractor to review submittals. You'll be doing design interpretation. Yeah, architects do that, but so do general contractors issue interpretations to their subs. And you'll be doing job site inspection, and I use that term deliberately, because as an architect, you do periodic observations, not rising to the level of inspection. As the design-build contractor, you can literally do inspections. You can do whatever you need to uncover work. You don't have to just eyeball it. You can be every bit as detailed as you want to be, or you can eyeball it the way you would as an architect. The bottom line is that if there are construction defects and you are responsible to the owner for them, the general contractor is identically responsible to you. So you become kind of transparent for issues of liability. Any event, that was the ideal, or that was the average. The project comes in on budget. Now let's assume you make a profit. Suppose it only cost the general contractor $920,000 to build the project. He had overestimated a little bit. Well, you get paid the same $1 million because that was a lump sum contract, but you only owe the general contractor $920,000, not $950,000, because a GMP contract is a cost plus to the GMP. So reimbursing him for cost plus up to $920,000 means that you're earning $80,000 for this project rather than $50,000, a windfall of $30,000. Now, my strong, strong recommendation is that whatever windfall you earn, you share with the general contractor 50-50. So if you earned a windfall of $30,000, you give $15,000 of that to the contractor. You're still sitting pretty with an above average profit, and the contractor just made a bonus and is thrilled with the result. Not only that, but the contractor, knowing that you have promised to share any windfall 50-50 with him, means that he knows you are incentivized to try to help him save money. What goes further toward building teamwork than you and the contractor having identical financial incentives to save money on the project? Now let's look at a bad example. Let's assume that the project goes over budget. The project comes in at, let's say, $970,000 instead of $950,000, which is the GMP. Well, you still get paid your $1 million by the owner, because that's lump sum, but you only have to pay the general contractor $950,000. Because that was his guaranteed maximum price, and he's lost $20,000 on the job. Well, I also strongly recommend that you agree to share his losses with him 50-50, which means that of his $20,000 loss, you would reimburse him for $10,000 of that loss out of the $50,000 that you earned for the construction phase. Now, I recommend that you cap that responsibility at your $50,000 construction phase fee. If he goes more than 10% over budget, there's a serious problem. But in any event, that even more strongly than sharing bonuses makes the contractor realize that you're on his side. Because if he loses a single dollar out of anything that you've done to him, you pay 50 cents of that. He knows from his pocketbook that you're on the same page together. And that's absolutely critical, because the key element of design build, the part where old dogs have trouble learning new tricks, is for the architect and the contractor to be on the same team. It is not a successful project for you unless the contractor makes a profit, and vice versa. The hardest thing you will have to do if you ever adopt this process is to re-educate your staffs and the contractor's staffs as to how this works and how you need to work together. It's foreign to a lot of people, but if you do it, and if you set up the financial structures that kind of force you to work hand in hand, it's much easier to gain that trust. Now, at this point, I often am asked, why work with a general contractor at all? Why not just cut him out of the equation and hire the trades myself? After all, I know how to build a building. Well, I've kind of weighed the pluses and minuses of doing that, and it's almost all minus. There are so many more advantages to having a general contractor as your teammate rather than multiple prime trades that I put together this slide to convince you of that. The most important one is the elimination of the construction risks. I mean, I'm standing up here as a lawyer telling you that you have less construction risk under this structure than you do traditionally. And that's because all of the risks you think you're taking on are truly passed through. And most of the other risks are avoided by the absence of the adversarial relationship that causes so many problems on the construction site. I mean, just statistically, the insurance companies and bonding companies will tell you that there are usually less than half as many claims on a design build job as there are on a traditional job, which is why I can't understand why they're not urging all architects to be going into design build, if nothing else from a liability standpoint. Another pro of having a general contractor is that its presence on the team can help assist you with marketing and sales. If the client turns to you and says, what experience do you have actually with construction? You can say, my teammate is XYZ General Contractors, and they just built three similar buildings last year, or whatever. Their presence on the team gives you a capacity that you otherwise just wouldn't have as an architectural firm. Here's a weird one that I had no idea was going to happen until it started happening in practice. The contractor will become your best friend. In order to make sure that you give your next project to him, he's going to try to give projects to you. I'll give an example. I'll actually use names because she's authorized it. I don't know how many of you know Diane Legg Kemp, former Skidmore architect, went out and formed her own firm, a high-level design professional, and was one of my guinea pigs starting this about 10 to 12 years ago. And they built the Girl Scouts of America headquarters building in a Chicago suburb using this structure with a very upper niche general contractor, and the project went great. It was wonderful and profitable, and it was one of the reasons I decided that this was important. Surprisingly, that general contractor was hired by a municipality to build a not very exciting warehouse type building on a wastewater treatment plant. And what did they do? But they turned around and hired Diane's firm to be their architect, not because she had any great expertise at this, and, you know, she was more of an upper-end design architect, but simply to pay her back a little bit for the profit they earned on the prior job, to give her a project she would never in 100 years have been thought for, simply as a means of saying thank you and asking to be put at the top of the list for the next job. So contractors will give you projects once they understand that you're in a position to give projects to them. A fourth, you won't be perceived as competing with a general contractor if you hire general contractors. You'll be one of their clients. But if you were to hire the trades directly, bypassing them and cutting them out of the project, you'd be a competitor. You'd be a general contractor yourself, and they would end up marketing against you rather than for you. Financial security. An owner may say, you don't have much of a balance sheet as a design firm. How do I know there's a financial source of stability or even a bond to back this project? And the answer is, you're right, as an architecture firm, I don't have a big balance sheet, but my teammate, the general contractor, does, and he's responsible to me just as I'm responsible to you, so ultimately his financial balance sheet or bonding capacity will be used to guarantee this project. Management expertise. I mean, I know that you understand construction, at least as an architect would understand construction, but probably most of you in this room don't understand construction the way a general contractor understands it, which is much more nuts and bolts and details, and they will supply a management expertise with subcontractors that you probably don't have. And finally, what I think is the decisive one, the generals are going to negotiate better deals with the subs than you are. Partly because they work with them all the time, so the subs are beholden to them. Partly because they know more about pricing than you do, so they'll know when they're getting a good deal and have unit prices to compare things to. So they will probably make up for their profit margin by getting lower subcontracts and increasing the profit margin for both of you. The cons, I think, aren't real strong. Yes, if you cut the general contractor out, you increase the profit margin available because you then can take his overhead and profit. except that your subcontracts are probably going to cost more, and I personally believe, although I can't back it up statistically, that that will make up for it. The big con is that it's old dog time. It's difficult to explain this structure to an owner. An owner will understand if you hire the trades, but an owner won't understand why you're hiring a general who's hiring the trades, and you'll need to show him that flip side of the coin slide to explain that this is just turning design build upside down in a way that's to his benefit. So my strong recommendation is that you work with a general contractor and that not that you hire the trades yourself. Now, I told you a while ago that architect-led design build is a win-win-win proposition for the owner, for you, and even surprisingly for the contractor. The next three slides will show you from each one's of their point of view exactly why this structure is better for them than traditional architecture and construction. Well, first of all, the advantages to the owner. Number one is design quality, at least compared to contractor-led design build. You ought to be the individual or the company balancing design quality on one hand versus cost and constructability. If the contractor is leading the design build team, he's making the decisions. You may want a certain piece of design to end up in the project. He'll simply veto it and say no, and you have no recourse because you don't go over his head to the client. The contractor is your client. Number two, and here's a big one. The owner can delay the design-build decision only when the architect leads the design-build team. Most owners don't really understand design-build. That's not surprising. Most architects don't truly understand it either. So it's going to be difficult to persuade a lot of owners from day one that they want to do design-build for this project. Now, when a contractor is making the pitch as the lead design builder, that's what the contractor's got to do. The contractor has to persuade the owner that from day one he ought to hire this design-build contractor to bring in the whole project. But the owner may not be willing to make that decision immediately. It may be an unsophisticated owner, or it may be an owner without authority. You're dealing with a facilities manager, and the facilities manager never got permission from the board of directors to do the project design-build, but he's got to start it right away. With architect-led design-build, he can hire you first, under your B-141 to start programming and schematic design. Well, he goes and talks to the board of directors about your guarantee and the opportunity to convert this to design build later on. The reason that this is the only style of design build where an owner can delay that decision is that this is the only logical style of design build where the first service provider to the owner is the one who's running the team. That's the reason it works. Third, you and the client, the owner, usually have the pre-existing relationship. Now, it's not necessarily the case, but in the overwhelming majority of situations, the architect and the owner have begun working together before there's a contractor on the scene, or at least a clear allegiance to one particular contractor. That means that you have the client relationship. I've actually had architectural clients who, when an owner of theirs has said, I'd like to do this project design build, have restructured things so that a contractor is contracting directly with the owner, and they're a sub to the contractor, giving up their client relationship and client control, if you want to call it that. That's absurd. There is no reason that you should throw away your direct prime relationship with the owner simply because the owner wants to do design build.